Welcome to Rise, a special documentary edition of Eastern Standard, produced in the studios of Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and our focus for this eighth episode in our series, a proposed 40-year U.S. Forest Service project that would involve clear-cutting, thinning, and the use of herbicides in the Daniel Boone National Forest on a part of the Cumberland Mountains known as the Jellicoes, approximately 5,000 acres in Whitley County and about 5,000 acres in McCreary County, along the Kentucky border with Tennessee. Jim Scheff, staff ecologist at the forest advocacy group Kentucky Heartwood, helps us get our bearings.
The Jellicoes are quite a different landform from the rest of the Danny Boone National Forest. So a lot of folks are probably most familiar with areas like the Red River Gorge or some of the areas around Laurel County, Laurel River Lake, where you have gorges and ravines and arches and those sorts of features. The Jellicoe Mountains are a sort of a higher relief, bigger mountain type of terrain. Folks might be familiar with them if you're driving I-75 down to Tennessee. About when you cross over the state line, you see those mountains off to your right, and those are the Jellicoe Mountains.
Leading the project is Tim Reed. He heads the Stearns Ranger District of the Daniel Boone National Forest.
That area is really lacking in any younger forest age classes and structure. Everything there is greater than 30 years old. Most everything out there, the majority, is over 80 years old. We come up with a proposal to help add a little diversity to the management of that area and the age class structure to provide some wildlife habitats, you know, early successional habitats, and give some diversity to help with the resiliency and the health of that forest area long term.
And the term of this project is what makes it unusual, 40 years instead of the usual 10 or 15. It would be one of the largest and longest-term logging projects ever proposed in the Daniel Boone. Lauren Kallmeyer is executive director of Kentucky Heartwood.
We can't understand why there would be a logging project proposed for a 40-year time frame when the forest plan itself, which is the guiding document for management of the forest, is only on a 10 to 15-year time frame.
Forest Ranger Tim Reed.
The current proposal, as currently written, would take place over that 40-year period. We have limits on what we can do in any 10-year period in our forest plan. So I know the numbers were somewhat large, and that may have confused some people at some point, that they think, well, if they sign this decision and do this project, they're going, the next couple of years, they're going to, you know, cut 5,000 acres of timber, which is not the case. As far as the regeneration treatments, where we'll be setting succession back year one, you know, using clear cut shelter woods, those kind of methods, we're limited in any 10-year period in that area to around 800 acres, roughly, of treatment over a 10-year period. So it's really a small amount, but because we're so limited on where we can do this work, it's very important that some of it gets done.
So that's the reason for spacing it out over a longer period of time?
Sure, yeah, and plus it makes it more transparent to the public to see what it would really take to maintain that small percentage of young forest over time.
My name is Teresa Martin, and my husband and I live on Little Wolf Creek Road. We've been there about 20 years.
Teresa Martin speaking before a town hall-style Forest Service scoping meeting last November at the Whitley County Cooperative Extension Office.
They're trying to balance, and we just talked about this, all sorts of different interests. So they have to manage it for hunting and recreation and clean water and old growth and young growth and all these different things. And all of us have an opinion on how this land should be managed.
It was the first opportunity for neighbors of the Jellicoes to speak their minds on the project.
Opinion. It doesn't even match my husband's opinion. So I guarantee you my opinion is not going to match all of yours, and all of yours is not going to match probably anybody else's. So it's a hard job these guys have, and women. But they're here to listen to us, and we're here to participate in this, and it is a requirement that they listen and that it is our right to participate. And so that's why we're here today.
Our aim with this report is to shed some light on the issues ahead of the next public comment opportunity, and we'll have more on that later in the hour. by airing perspectives from many sides of the matter, including those raised during that November meeting with Forest Service officials by people whose homes and properties hug the Daniel Boone and the Jellicoes.
This land is owned by the people. I own it, and the Forest Service folks own it, every single one of you. We're all part owners of this land. And the Forest Service, we say it all the time, well, that National Forest, that's government land. It's government managed. They're the stewards of it, but we own it.
Landslides. We live 25 feet away from the bottom of a mountain you're all going to be working on. So I definitely don't want to see trees and crap on top of my house when I come home from work one day.
Logging, strip mining all contributes to flooding. And according to the Federal Government Office of Surface Mining, when you have a mature, healthy forest, it'll soak up 75% of the rainfall. And that logging and the stripping definitely contributed to the flooding in eastern Kentucky. And I think, you know, looking at this proposal, we really need to, is that what we want for this area?
Reporter Marianne Lavelle.
To the people who live around the forest and who have voiced their concerns about this, they don't feel that this ameliorates the situation at all. The fact that it's taking place over 10 or 40 years, really. This is a project that is supposed to last 40 years. What that translates to them is that there's just going to be constant logging, constant chainsaws, constant bulldozers, trucks going back and forth on the roads for the next 40 years, that their mountain, which instead of being this really, really quiet, peaceful place, will be kind of an industrial logging site.
Hundreds of letters objecting to clear-cutting in the Jellicoes have poured into the Forest Service, and there are some of support as well. You can find them on our site, weku-rise.org. Inside Climate News reporter Marianne Lavelle has researched and written extensively on the Jellicoe project and breaks down the various perspectives into three categories.
The timber industry looks at that as a resource that it's time to harvest. At the same time, from the point of view of climate change, it's a really important time to preserve those trees. And from the point of view of people who live near there, they know forest is just a really rare resource that they can't even put a value on. It means so much to them and their families, especially if they've lived there their whole lives.
Following the roadmap laid out for us by Marianne Lavelle brings us first to the timber industry perspective and a question for Forest Ranger Tim Reed. When these trees are cut down, what happens to the timber?
Our timber contracts are commercially bid out, and the local purchasers would take those, you know, and mill them for wood products. Usually provides a lot of benefit to our local economy in the local area and regionally as well.
Bob Bauer leads the Kentucky Forest Industries Association.
From the industry standpoint, the big question is, you know, these old growth forests, if you want to call them that, and that aren't managed, you know, at some point those trees fall over and that carbon goes back into the atmosphere. So, you know, I think a portion of the industry's thought is, you know, if you're actively managing that forest, you're going to store a lot more carbon because you're getting that growth on the bigger, better trees. And then if you have a harvest, you have to consider that every bit of that tree is used in the process, and over half of that is going to go into a long-term forest product, such as your house, your furniture, all those type of things. So, you know, that to me is the best way to store carbon. It's in a piece of woodwork that's in your home, you know. So how does that fit into that process? We think that's a part of that carbon storage, and all of this is sort of a new type of thing.
Bauer mentioned the presence of wood in our lives. It is everywhere. Homes, furniture, paper, surfboards, cutting boards, you name it. But then there also is this.
A lot of people want to preserve their forest.
Reporter Marianne Lavelle.
the timber industry found through its own polling that it supported and focus groups that private forest owners don't want logging on their land often. And this has been a real challenge for the timber industry.
The market for timber is mixed, with newsprint and paper for books, magazines, and brochures being displaced by digital technologies, and a consumer shift from fast foods during the COVID pandemic, there's been a plunge in demand for the pulpwood used to make paper products. Many paper mills have shut down in recent years. On the other hand, in May, Domtar Paper made a $51 million investment in upgrading its mill in Hancock County. Domtar, the largest U.S. manufacturer of print and copy paper, owned by a member of one of Indonesia's wealthiest families, employs 400 people at the Hallsville Mill, where they turn out a variety of fiber-based products such as communication, specialty, and packaging papers. Marianne Lavelle reports that Domtar is just one of the wood products companies that have formed partnerships with hunting and wildlife groups to help the timber industry gain access from owners like the Forest Service to large stands of older trees, the most valuable timber available.
The timber companies are rarely in the front of the pack as far as lobbying for these kinds of projects. But they definitely are the ultimate beneficiaries. And one of the interesting things that we found is that they work very closely with these hunting and sportsmen's groups that have been out in the lead pushing for these kinds of logging projects. And the hunting groups are in the middle facilitating these projects. In some cases, they actually have a contract to work for the Forest Service to manage the timber sales. And on the other hand, they also work closely with the timber companies.
And as the bourbon industry experiences rapid growth, there is heavy demand for the white oak used to make barrel staves. Kentucky Heartwood's Jim Sheff.
We're seeing tremendous over-harvesting these species, especially the white oaks, really driven by the bourbon industry. The prices on oak or white oak are just through the roof, and it's being stripped out of our forests. And it's understood that within a few decades, we could really run out of oak in these forests. They need more light, but the problem is if you remove too much of that timber, those oaks also can't compete with faster growing species. And so in order to manage for those oaks to help perpetuate it, it requires a lot of slow management, stepwise work that takes care and time. That's not what we're seeing with these projects on the Danny Boone National Forest. One of the things that's incredibly frustrating is, you know, whatever direction you're coming at this from, whether it's, you know, from a commodity product perspective or you're concerned about preservation of our native forests, we see the Forest Service saying that, you know, this management is needed to perpetuate our oak again and again and again. And some management is needed, but then they're prescribing timber harvest and management that we just know will absolutely fail. It's very frustrating.
Climate change and trees have a special relationship. I brought it up in my conversation with Kentucky Heartwood's Jim Sheff. We out in the public are hearing on the one hand that we're experiencing climate change. It's no longer a matter of whether it's going to happen. It is happening. And it's directly related to the extreme weather events that we've been experiencing all over the country, but definitely here in Kentucky. We hear that on the one hand. We hear on the other hand that one important solution, at least to arresting global warming, is to preserve forests, that forests absorb and sequester the CO2 that's causing the greenhouse gas effect. It seems like a really bad time to be cutting down trees.
Yeah, the science of understanding about how forests sequester carbon over time has changed considerably in recent decades. So it used to be thought that as forests age, so in our region, say, typically getting to be 80 or 100 years old, that overall they stop increasing the amount of carbon or biomass that the system brings in, so that the amount leaving through decomposition and what's called respiration, the amount leaving the system is essentially the same as the amount coming in. But over the last few decades, understanding about tree physiology and forest development has shown conclusively that those older forests continue to sequester large amounts of carbon, increase the amount of biomass held in those forests. And a lot of that thinking, while it's definitely in the scientific literature, has for some reason not made its way into the Forest Service and their planning.
There is tension around the age of trees, and as we do what we can to stay ahead of the effects of climate change, which does the best job of absorbing and storing carbon dioxide, young trees or older ones? In her reporting for Inside Climate News, Marianne Lavelle finds that the Jellicoe Plan is part of a campaign for young forest creation on public and private forest land throughout the eastern U.S. And that's on a collision course with climate advocates who, backed by recent science, are calling for the protection of mature and old-growth trees. There seems to be something of a discrepancy or differences of opinion about which does the best job of pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, mature and old-growth forests or young forests, with the Forest Service contending that old forests store more carbon but sequester it much more slowly than younger managed forests. And as old trees die or are lost to insects or storms or fire, they release their carbon back into the atmosphere. What have you learned about that debate?
Right. This is a really very hot debate in the whole climate science arena. One thing that's become clear over time is that if you look at the individual trees, old trees, or those 80-year-old trees that we see out in the Daniel Boone, they are continuing to not only store carbon, but absorb carbon. And they continue to absorb more each year. So they really are still doing the work. The problem is when you have a stand of all old trees, some of them are going to die. Some of them, you know, get struck by lightning, pushed over in storms. So often a stand of old trees will have a lot of dead trees and a lot of trees that aren't drawing in carbon as much. So that's why the Forest Service will say, well, a young stand will absorb carbon more quickly. But what they don't bring into this equation is that if you plant a young stand after you've done clear cutting, the soil disturbance is so great that the science shows it takes 10 or 20 years for it to really begin absorbing more carbon than it gives out to the atmosphere. And climate scientists say, we don't have that kind of time. We don't have 10 or 20 years to get that carbon-absorbing forest back.
A massive international study in 2014, led by researchers with the U.S. Geological Survey, found not only that older trees store more carbon than do younger ones, but that their ability to absorb carbon grows continually as they age.
The science of understanding about how forests sequester carbon over time has changed considerably in recent decades.
Jim Scheff, staff ecologist at Kentucky Heartwood.
Our understanding at this point, and really specifically with regard to the forests of our region, is that, you know, those younger trees can grow faster than older trees, though not necessarily. But when a forest is logged, there's a tremendous amount of carbon that's released through that whole process. So that can be soil disturbance through the building of logging roads and skid trails, dragging logs out of the forest. Also just sawing material into sawdust and smaller things that decompose much more quickly. There's a number of studies out there showing that when you factor in the amount of emissions that are tied to the extraction of that timber, that the amount of any increase in the amount of carbon sequestration by those younger trees relative to older trees is washed out so that it ends up being a net carbon emitter, at least for many decades.
We don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket.
Ranger Tim Reed.
We don't want all young forests. We don't want all middle-aged forests. We don't want all old forests. But we do want a mix. And the mix that we're, you know, have here on the Daniel Boone is the majority is going to be older, mature forest and always will be under our current forest plan. But we're trying to just provide a little bit of diversity that will help, you know, that can provide a lot in terms of wildlife habitat, having early successional habitat, and plan that out over a longer period of time so people can see what it will take to maintain that.
The Forest Industries Association's Bob Bauer.
You know, when you walk through that forest and you see these trees that are larger and you figure they're, and maybe they are, they're 80 years old or 100 years old, and you see trees next to it that are, you know, those trees could be maybe 20, 24 inches in diameter, and you see other trees there that may be 10 inches in diameter or 12 inches in diameter, you know, the thing with that is those trees grow in competition, so especially with hardwoods, however much sunlight and however much they can get up through that forest canopy depends on how fast they grow. So sometimes as foresters look at those properties and check those, you know, they'll find some of those 12 or 14 inch trees are 80 or 100 years old because they've never had the room to grow. So, you know, to go in and cut the trees around it and say, oh, this tree's going to take off, if it's 100 years old, it's not going to jump out and grow to be a large tree. It's just simply going to grow very slowly. You know, it's sort of grown its growth. So, you know, there's a lot of keys to, you know, you can't just look at that tree and say, oh, that's probably this old by the size of the tree. There's a lot of other things, especially in the hardwoods, that make it a pretty complicated process. So, you know, if you went by that and said, well, these trees are 80 years old and they're, let's leave them, they're 14 inches in diameter, they're going to be a great big forest someday. Well, they are never going to be that big. They're not going to release. So in those cases, a lot of times, those trees are the ones that may come out or be thinned out so that the younger, more vigorous trees can grow.
One of the methods being proposed by the Forest Service involves a term that, for many, raises red flags. I brought it up with Ranger Tim Reed. What about clear-cutting? That term can raise alarms. It raises the image, I think, in a lot of minds of going in and just mowing down acres of trees. Tell us more about that process.
Sure. Clear-cutting is a silviculture practice where you remove the majority of the canopy trees to get maximum amounts of sunlight down to the forest floor to aid in regenerating the new stand of trees that are coming up. And we have some variations on that that may leave more, you know, trees in the canopy called shelter wooding. But in general, it's a regeneration treatment. It's a tool, and we analyze to make sure that that tool is used in the right place, you know, in the right landscape to be successful and not cause other damages to other resources.
Currently proposed, but subject to change, clear-cutting 28 sites in the Jellicoes. When combined, a total of 1,016 acres over that span of four decades. Reporter Marianne Lavelle.
If you look at the Forest Service plan, it does indeed look like a mosaic. They're all different colors and little plots here and there. And some of them are 100% clear cut. And then others are what might be called a deferred harvest, or they have other names for it. Shelterwood is one other name for it. But what they do is they first remove 80% or 90% of the trees, and then 10 years later, they will come back to do the rest.
Anytime you clear cut, you are inviting in invasive species to show up.
Kentucky Heartwood's Lauren Kallmeyer.
Invasive species love clear, disturbed areas. And unfortunately, in the Jellicoes, from old logging projects from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, There is Tree of Heaven, which, you know, an invasive tree that has come in and taken over large parts of the forest in that area. So it's already there. And so the more vegetation that we remove through logging, the more it just sort of gives this Tree of Heaven an invitation to spread. And when we have more invasives, we have less biodiversity. So that's a huge problem.
And what's the problem with the Tree of Heaven? Kentucky Heartwood's Jim Sheff.
Tree of Heaven has really sparse root systems. And those root systems, I don't think, hold the soil together as much as the native hardwood species do. So that even after a forest is growing back in one of those areas, you're not going to get that cohesion of the ground, of the soil, from the root structure as you would from the native forest. So I think you're going to continue to perpetuate some of these problems that way.
The Forest Service project also calls for what foresters call shelter wood treatments, a series of thinnings that establish a new generation of trees under the shelter of older trees with the intent to stimulate seed production and create good seed bed conditions on the forest floor. These treatments would occur over four decades in 38 separate stands in the Jellicoes, totaling about 1,900 acres. The deferment harvest method would be used on 2,400 acres of the forest. The harvest leaves a stand of scattered or small groups of older trees, and about 4,500 acres would be thinned with full rows of trees removed, allowing those remaining to grow to their full potential over the next 6 to 8 years. The prospect of clear-cutting and these other logging methods on mountains near their properties and homes was behind much of the anxiety heard during that initial public comment meeting in Whitley County last fall.
Whoever's even remotely considering approving this needs to be fired. That's all I've got to say.
Often when we cover stories like Jellicoe, we typically cover the economic and environmental impacts of the story. There is another element at work here, the human element.
Eastern Standard's Crystal Jones talked with a neighbor of Jellicoe Mountain.
Appalachians are not shy about our love of our land. It sustained us for generations, although challenging at times. Projects like the Jellicoe Vegetation Management Plan, which calls for drastic change to a deeply familiar setting, can affect those who call it home. Brandon Bolin lives in Whitley County. When he looks out his front door, he sees the curvy backbone of Jellicoe Mountain on his horizon. Bolin has a deep relationship with this land.
I was raised in these mountains, raised right here, what we call hollers and stuff. And if you've never experienced or never been up there, it's hard to understand and really to explain it to you, because there is a peace up there of quietness and no noise like you've never seen. But the thing is, the National Forest is our getaway. We just open our back door and it's there. We're sentimental people, I guess you'd say. We're a different type of people here in Southeast Kentucky. We hold on to things and there's traditions.
Bolin represents many who see this area as something akin to sacred and is concerned that the Jellicoe Vegetation Plan will leave the land scarred and unhealthy. He is, however, a unique case of an individual who embodies both sides of the argument of the Jellicoe Project.
It sounds kind of crazy. I mean, if you read the article Marianne put out, I am a logger. I love logging. I've been in it in my blood. Even if you're not doing it, you still want to. If you're working somewhere else because times are hard, you've always wanted to log if it's in your blood.
Bolin's concerns lie not in the idea of the project itself, but rather the growing distance between the project and the people and communities it would affect the most. We talked about a few concerns, starting with the plan itself. According to Bolin, it's not the proposition of the logging itself, but how they plan to do it that concerns him.
I mean, it's been logged before, but nothing like what they're talking about. So that's what's so scary about this whole situation, is you have to follow state regulations. There's a lot of loggers that want to log that, but there's a lot of loggers that would log the National Forest the right way. If you bring somebody in from out of state, I mean, we worry that, you know, they'll just, if a hydraulic line busts, oh well, we'll just cover it up a little bit better and go home. And yes, I do believe local loggers would be more honest about if we run across something, a situation that was going to affect the people of the community, I believe they would be more honest. The thing about getting set up and logging is, you know, I want to see what their eco study was about, because I know that there's the Cumberland Darter, which is endangered in the creeks below in Little Wolf Creek. And they're talking about spraying herbicides, okay? And they said it was pretty much like a Roundup type situation, you know, with the weed killer type thing. But everything ends up in our water system. And there's still a lot of people that don't run off city water. They have wells. And anything you spray at the top of the mountain, eventually, whether it's micro parts of it or whatever, it's still going to end up in the water system. And yes, I do believe local loggers would be more honest about if we run across something, a situation that was going to affect the people of the community.
And there is also the issue of jobs.
But the thing is, we just lost one of the biggest buyers of wood with Evergreen shutting down in Canton, North Carolina. And it shut down the 141 chip mill in Royal Blue, pretty much Caribou, Tennessee. So with that being shut down, loggers nowadays are really starving. Why not let it economically benefit your people of your community, the ones that lived here, that has worked here, that has, you know, paid their dues? We have tried to get some of the representatives of the state in our area to educate them on this. We're all about supporting our community. We shop local. Money stays local.
He says he understands the need for the project, but is unsure of the methods and the timing.
My understanding of the government wanting a clear cut is you're going to waste at least, because in logging, 70% of your pay is your chipwood, waywood, or some people call it pulpwood. And, you know, you get maybe 30, 35% of its logs. But now in the national forest, there's a lot of mature, big stuff. But you're still going to waste a lot of stuff because the market is really down right now.
Bowling and his family say despite the possibility of losing the forest he feels akin to, he will remain in Whitley County.
We hold on to things, and there's traditions. And then there's some people that just know, let's cut it. Let's gut it. Let's clear cut it all down. Let's roll with it. Because they're looking at the monetary gains and not looking at what you're actually losing, because the good Lord's not creating no more land. There is no more land being created. God blessed us with the land that we've got. And, you know, they can't come across it and they can't cut it. But, no, we'll never leave. It's just, it's a wonderland, like it. But not, you know, not everybody is a mountain-type person that likes the outdoors. But if you do, I think you need to get out and join us and just feeling what the National Forest is all about.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Crystal Jones.
Back with more in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series on WEKU.
This is Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, June 12th, the Northeast Christian Church in Lexington will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Johnny Green, an Orphan Survival, 1841 to 1920. The program will begin at 10 a.m. and is sponsored by the Kentucky Educational Development Corporation. On Tuesday, June 13th, the Johnson County Library in Paintsville will host Primetime Family Reading. Programming starts at 5:30 p.m. On Thursday, June 15th, the Scott County Public Library in Georgetown will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Lily Cornett, A Voice for the Forest. The program will begin at 6:30 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. For Kentucky Humanities, I'm Sherry Lawson.
We're back with more of the latest in the Eastern Standard documentary series, Rise. You can learn all about the series and listen to all 8 episodes online at weku-rise.org. The focus of this hour, a proposed 40-year U.S. Forest Service project that would bring timber operations, including clear-cutting and herbicides, to about 10,000 acres of the Jellicoes, part of the Cumberland Mountains in Whitley and McCreary counties along the Kentucky-Tennessee border. The first opportunity for people who live in the area to voice objections to or support for the project came last November 17th at a scoping meeting hosted by the Forest Service at the Whitley County Cooperative Extension Office. What's in this for the people and economies of McCreary and Whitley counties? According to District Ranger Tim Reed, business and jobs.
We're doing vegetation management. You know, the opportunity there exists for us to help support the local economies through the wood products industry when that meets our prescription needs for the treatments that we want to do on the land. So it can be an important part of providing for local and regional economic benefits.
Bob Bauer with the Kentucky Forest Industries Association.
If you check over Kentucky from the 50s to now, you know, we've actually have more forest land than we did, you know, 60 or 70 years ago. You know, the loss of forest land when it happens is not really related to logging. It's more related to development, you know, whether it's a shopping mall or housing subdivision, or, you know, there are some lands cleared for agriculture, but there's also a lot of lands that go back from pasture into forest. So, you know, the development type things are what you're seeing. You know, if there's a loss of forest land, that's really the issue, because luckily with our hardwood forests, no matter how much you harvest out there, if nothing's done to it, your next forest comes up. You don't have to plant that. You know, your next forest is already there, from the young trees that are, you know, under there to the sprouts of, you know, whatever was cut. So, you know, it sort of sustains itself.
But another use of the forest as an economic driver has captured imaginations as the coal industry has faded and the region searches for new ways to support local economies. From the Forest Service's scoping meeting last fall.
There was a state senator came to McCreary County a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and his visit was talked in the McCreary County newspaper. He said McCreary County's best chance for economic improvement is tourism.
Yeah.
He said, if we are to, he said, we're in the same mountains, the same fall colors, the same trees and Smoky Mountains, so we can be the next chapter. So that's almost a nightmare. But McCreary County has beautiful old growth timber.
And what I think we should do in this area is build trails and not cut down trees. Right. And because this is a place where everybody should want to come and go hiking. This is a magnificent area.
Kentucky Heartwood's Jim Schiff.
That's one of the frustrations with a lot of these projects. You know, the Forest Service will usually have a pre-proposal analysis period, they'll call it like a collaborative period. And I've been involved in this stuff for a long time. And when people come to these meetings or send in comment letters, usually what they're concerned about is, you know, trails, campsites, access issues. And they just, you know, love the forest and love the opportunities to get out, clean streams, et cetera. And the Forest Service always say, hey, everything's on the table. But the reality is it's not. When a project comes out, you know, there's usually little or no recreational component. And, you know, the statements are usually, well, we can look at that later. That's just not part of this project. But we know from internal documents that a lot of this recreational stuff is just a non-starter. The Forest Service doesn't have a lot of money for that. I mean, and that's ultimately a congressional issue that I think there should be a lot more transparency about, because, I mean, most people, when they think about national forest lands, they think about recreation. But the reality is that's not where most of the resources for national forest management go. With the Jellicoe area, you know, it's over 20,000 acres of mountainous, stunning national forest area. And, you know, there's no maintained trails at all. And there's, I think, four modestly maintained campsites in that whole area. That's it.
The problem I have with that statement, you know, is that they make it sound like it's exclusive. You have to do one or the other, and you do not.
Ranger Tim Reed.
We need good, healthy ecosystems and good veg management projects to develop that, and recreation can also be a part. We get a lot of dispersed recreation use down in that area. It's a very popular hunting area. You know, we've got campsites on Jellicoe Creek. So it's not exclusive of each other. You know, they can complement each other.
When you go online to McCrarytourism.com and WhitleyCountyTourism.com, there's no doubt where these counties are placing hopes for the future. Both homepages call attention to opportunities for whitewater rafting and kayaking, fishing, hiking, rock climbing, horseback and ATV riding, and mountain biking. Earlier in the hour, we heard from people who live close to the Jellicoes and their concerns about the prospect of four decades of logging operations near their homes and properties. Landslides worry many. Noise and pollution concern others. The use of herbicides and the possible contamination of drinking water sources is often mentioned. But for many who live in the area, it's also very much about a reverence for the natural world, for the woods. What happens, for example, to the worlds within those woods, universes within each rotting log, each pine cone containing a galaxy of life, the communities of creatures living in creeks, streams, burrows, and nests, the relationships of organisms to one another, to their physical surroundings, to the forest ecosystem, and to humans? What are the consequences when those worlds are disturbed or even destroyed? Kentucky Heartwood's Lauren Kallmeyer.
When you lose species in that web of life, or you lose a species in, you know, a food chain, it can disrupt the rest of the ecosystem. And so, you know, you never know what role, well, sometimes we know the role that certain things play in the ecosystem, and then sometimes we realize after we've lost them the role that they play in the ecosystem. And so, you know, because it's a system, right, all the parts of the system are important.
Jellicoe neighbor and logger Brandon Boland.
The world was designed to run itself. We self-sustain, and, you know, it's just like the food chain. Everything is here for a reason. And that the land has went for 200 years, and it's just fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it right now. It's taking care of itself. The land's not... you know, deteriorating because the trees are growing too much.
What happens when we take a moment to get down into the weeds, or in this case, down into a forest floor that had been left untouched for generations? In her book, Finding the Mother Tree, Suzanne Simard, a world-renowned ecologist who discovered how trees communicate underground through networks of fungi, explained to Fresh Air's Ray Davies that trees in a forest, old growth, so-called hub or mother trees, are interconnected and communicate with one another and across species chemically, issuing warnings, for instance. Put in human terms, says Simard, trees can care for one another.
So as you've looked at this, you've discovered that the older trees are wired into, connected to many, many other trees and plants in the forest. You call these hub trees or mother trees, right? What's their role in the forest?
Yeah, so these hub trees are connected to most of the other trees. And because they have these big root systems, that they're able to make these connections. And in connecting with all the trees of different ages, they can actually facilitate the growth of these understory seedlings. And so they do this by, you know, the seedlings will link into the network of the old trees and benefit from that huge uptake resource capacity. And the old trees would also pass a little bit of carbon and nutrients and water to the little seedlings at crucial times in their lives that actually help them survive.
Wow, they're like the big mom or dad of the forest.
Yeah, I mean, they are. They nurture the new generations of seedlings, and they do lots of other things in ecosystems, too, that many other people have studied. So they also store huge amounts of carbon, and they're also, you know, scaffolding for a lot of biodiversity. So birds love to live in these trees, squirrels, and, of course, the mycorrhizal network is hugely diverse. So they're a big source of biodiversity as well.
Right. So one of the policy recommendations that flows from this, I suppose, is if you're going to harvest most of the trees in the forest, leave these old hub trees, mother trees.
Well, for the resilience of the forest, yes, that's right. To leave the old trees is like leaving the legacy, the genetic legacy that of these trees that have actually lived for a long, long time through previous climatic regimes and extremes. And so their DNA is actually, you know, evolved to deal with, you know, changes in the future. But they also are legacies in the biodiversity that they store and that they're able to help the recovery of forests after they've been disturbed.
The proposed Forest Service project in the Daniel Boone National Forest is not a done deal. Hurdles do remain. A required environmental site assessment is due soon.
It's a little too early to know exactly when I'll be able to put out the draft environmental assessment, which would trigger the next 30-day comment period for the public. We're probably still looking, late summer, have that. There's still a lot of work to be done. Like I said, we're in the process of analysis right now, and probably still looking at, probably an August time frame of trying to have that out. But it's not set in stone just yet.
In the meantime, skepticism remains. Kentucky Heartwood's Jim Scheff.
We hope that the Forest Service will consider all of these issues, but we're not real confident that they will.
And as Jellicoe neighbor Teresa Martin mentioned during last November's scoping meeting in Whitley County.
I've talked to some of you, not all of you, and my fellow organizers have talked to some of you. And what you keep telling us is you think the U.S. Forest Service folks, please don't take offense, but they're going to not pay attention to what we say, and they're just going to pretend to listen to us, and then they can go back and do it the way they want. And they're going to listen to the experts that they've got, and they're not going to allow us to participate. And I'm here to say I am pretty sure that's not true. And the reason is they have told us repeatedly, we want to listen to you. Mr. Reed said this. We will listen to you, and we will allow you to participate, and we will consider your input. And hopefully modify the plan to take our input into account.
My question for Forest Ranger Tim Reed. What do you think people are misunderstanding about this project?
Well, some of the things I think, Tom, as far as misunderstanding is, again, they think, they hear these large numbers over 40 years, and they think, that's going to happen immediately and not be spaced out. It gives a little bit of a skewed picture sometimes. I think that's part of it. And then I think the other concern is that they want to be assured, that we're going to analyze fully all of these issues and, address these concerns that people have. And, that's what we'll be looking at in the environmental assessment when it comes out. And, we want to make sure we're doing the right treatment in the right place at the right time. And that's what we're striving to do.
Something interesting emerges from the way the Jellicoe conversation has played out so far. We might not have even noticed this in earlier times when civility in public discussions was more of a given. The heated, often openly hostile exchanges that we hear so often today were once fairly rare. These days, it can seem as though the civility train has left the station. Special Topics reporter Chris Begley has some thoughts about the lost art of agreeing to disagree agreeably, and a time when compromise was a valued goal.
In the 1890s, there were national debates about how to protect the natural world in the face of the damage wrought by decades of industrialization. Two men came to represent opposing sides of that debate. Thomas Muir, one of the country's leading naturalists, argued for preserving natural areas intact, and he was important in the establishment of the national park system. Gifford Pinchot represented the other side, arguing for conservation of areas to preserve our supply of things like timber, and he became the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service. These are two very different philosophies, and we see elements of this debate still continuing to the present day. But there's something else that both the historic and contemporary debates have in common, and that's an honest conversation built on respect, and that's important. Gifford Pinchot and John Muir were friends, at least for much of their lives. They went camping and fishing and spent time together in the natural world that they were both concerned about. They talked and listened to each other. They shaped each other's ideas. They learned from each other and were forced to examine their own positions. They didn't compromise their ethics or come to some middle-of-the-road conclusion. They continued to disagree about many things, but their combined efforts resulted in the increased protection of many natural areas, and they would not have been nearly as successful overall had they not found their common ground. Their legacies, in the form of the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service, still shape our country. Having a debate where we listen and consider what the other side has to say, and where we are generous in attributing motive and intent, allows us to challenge our own assumptions, find strengths and weaknesses in our own position, and find the common ground on which we can begin to look for a solution. This does not mean settling for some watered-down compromise where we land in the middle of every argument. It means respecting the concerns and positions of our neighbors without prematurely writing them off as uneducated, greedy, or unrealistic. When I look at people at the center of a debate or of an issue, I always think back to those that I've seen negotiating important issues for my entire life. I think of my grandfather, Joe Begley, who seemed very effective at talking to radically different groups of people who seemed to have little in common. He listened to people, and he found the underlying concern. One phrase of his is often quoted, "Compromise hell." He was not looking for a politically expedient middle ground, that's obvious. But the things he would not compromise on were informed by people of all stripes, with different specific concerns, who he knew and to whom he listened. In a family, we consider each other when we make a decision, or we should. Most of us have seen the resulting disaster when we don't. In a household, we listen. In a community, we must also. Now, some arguments are not made in good faith, and we can recognize those, but that's not an assumption I would want to make about a neighbor who voices concerns about something. A century ago, Pinchot and Muir listened to each other. I hear that happening again as we discuss how to proceed today.
Eastern Standard Special Topics reporter, Chris Begley. Thanks for joining us. The Eastern Standard documentary series Rise is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, G. Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Crystal Jones, general assignment reporter, Chris Begley, special topics reporter, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Our thanks to Marianne Lavelle with Inside Climate News for the walk through her in-depth reporting on the Jellicoe Project. And to Kentucky Heartwood for a recording of the Forest Service scoping meeting in Whitley County last November. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also find RISE online at weku-rise.org. And you can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts. That includes Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.